And you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio or online at kpfa.org. My name is Sasha Lilly. Today we're talking about the history and legacy of the militant anti-racist and anti-imperialist organization Weatherman, later known as the Weather Underground. My guest is Philadelphia-based activist and scholar Dan Berger. He's the author of Outlaws of America, The Weather Underground and the Politics of Solidarity, published by AK Press, as well as editor of Letters from Young Activists, Today's Rebels Speak Out, along with Kenyon Farrow and Chesa Boudin. Dan is a PhD candidate at the University of Pennsylvania. So, Dan, I wonder if you can talk about briefly the sort of actions that the Weather Underground took from the beginning of going underground in 1970 to the dissolution of the organization in the late 70s, and how effective you think they were in achieving the goals that they set out for themselves.
Yeah, it's a great question in terms of both sides of it, and in terms of measuring it, it is both a great and a difficult question in terms of being able to quantify it. I think in terms of just the goals that they set out, in an article on kind of reflecting on the Weather Underground that's quoted in the book, David Gilbert talks about five aspects that he said were key to the organization, which were to draw off some of the repressive heat concentrated on Black, Native, and Latino movements, to create a leading political example of white solidarity with national liberation, to educate about key political issues, to identify the institutions most responsible for oppression, which were in practice government or corporate, and to encourage others to intensify activism despite state repression. So what that meant in practice, I think, was, you know, generally responding to crimes that were going on. So after the murder of George Jackson 35 years ago today, the group bombed two offices of the California Department of Corrections. Other radicals bombed a third office in an unrelated and unconnected action, but also in solidarity with the Black movement and in response to Jackson's murder. A year previously, after the murder of George Jackson's younger brother, Jonathan Jackson, who died in a militant action attempting to free political prisoners, the group similarly bombed offices in California. So one thing that they did was particularly targeting aspects of state repression in response to the murder of particularly Black activists and Black leaders. So that was police stations, courthouses, and Department of Corrections. I guess perhaps more famously, they're known for their actions in opposition to the war in Vietnam and escalations of the war in Vietnam, including bombing of the Capitol building and of the Pentagon in 1971 and 1972, respectively. You know, other actions apart from bombings included writing, publishing, and distributing a book called Prairie Fire in 1974, and later a news magazine called Osawatomie. And these were, you know, again, part of its attempts to highlight key political issues and to engage in dialogue with various sectors of the left.
And why did people eventually decide to come above ground, and what were the consequences for those who gave themselves up?
Well, yeah, after the war's end, you know, I think it was with the end of the Vietnam War in 1975, I think, brought a crisis for many people in the radical left, both from the New Communist Movement and Weather and elsewhere. And I think part of the reason for the crisis was that many of these groups mistook the broad anti-war politics for a deeper anti-imperialist consciousness that proved not to be there. So with the war's end, but U.S. empire still existing, there was a lot of, you know, reconsidering about strategies for the way forward. And I think that there were differences, particularly between leadership of the Weather Underground and some of its members, about the best ways to proceed. And after a very, you know, broad, well-attended multiracial conference called the Hard Times Conference that had a very kind of reformist agenda, criticisms both from within and outside the organization began to really express themselves loudly and eventually tore the organization apart in 1976. And so after that, people were really kind of racking their brains about what to do, and most people decided to turn themselves in, particularly after kind of a breakaway organization was attempted an action and was five members were arrested. So I think at that point, most people began to turn themselves in and didn't really know what to expect. I mean, most of the major charges were dropped in 1974 with revelations of Watergate and similar government misconduct. But still, this was an organization that committed itself to the overthrow of the U.S. government. And so people, you know, turned themselves in nervously, often in some kind of consultation with lawyers, and almost uniformly got probation. Very few that turned themselves in received any jail time. And you know, later, some people decided to go back underground. Some people never surfaced. And several of those people were subsequently arrested, trying other actions.
Well, you just mentioned the fact that the government had broken so many laws in trying to catch members of the Weather Underground that it was hard to prosecute them later because of that kind of malfeasance. Tell us about that effort known as COINTELPRO, which was part of a much larger effort on the part of the U.S. Government to infiltrate the left and break apart the left in the 1960s and 70s.
Yeah, and there were many government attempts to do that. COINTELPRO was certainly the most famous, but not the only one. It stood for the Counterintelligence Program and was initiated by the FBI in concert with the CIA's Operation Chaos, and really in coordination with many local and state police departments around the country. And, of course, its tactics most infamously included murder, such as that of Fred Hampton, numerous other black and indigenous leaders, but also more subtly the range of petty arrests to waste time and money, the various efforts to sow disunity and distrust and really break apart both organizations, as well as any effort at coalition building, particularly multiracial coalition building and coalition building within black communities.
Some critics on the left saw the Weather Underground as excessively provocative. Do you know if there were agents provocateurs who were involved in any way with the Weather Underground?
The only infiltrator was the person who I mentioned earlier, Larry Grathwall, who blew his cover quickly after the townhouse explosion in March of 1970, which led to the arrest of two folks on fairly minor charges. But the group proved itself otherwise remarkably successful at avoiding infiltration or similar such efforts.
And you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Dan Berger, whose voice you just heard, author, anti-racism activist, and scholar of the Weather Underground. He joins me by phone from Philadelphia, where he's a graduate student. So in the time that we have left, and there's not all that much time, I want to talk about your criticisms of the Weather Underground. During the 1960s, people of color and women turned the spotlight on racism and sexism as systemic forms of oppression. And clearly we know that anti-racism was a crucial facet of the Weather Underground's work, but what about anti-sexism?
Yeah, I think that's really a crucial issue, and I really, I mean, some of my favorite interviews were with the former women members of the group who really, you know, exemplified some of the difficulties and the tensions at that time and you know, offering some lessons for today. And I think one of the more consistent things that folks said was the ways in which, for people who went underground, it felt as if they were arguing against themselves, whether to side with a feminist movement that they felt didn't prioritize solidarity or go with an anti-imperialist movement that didn't prioritize women's liberation. And those who went underground, you know, siding with the latter felt a loss. Those who stayed above ground were really able to find those women's communities that were anti-imperialist and obviously firmly committed to women's liberation. But I think, you know, in practice, the Weather Underground comprised many strong feminists, but as an organization, never had a commitment to women's liberation or confronting, you know, male oppression, male privilege. They did, you know, a good job in terms of trying to shatter gender roles and holding up the notion that women could be fighters and women could be militants. And yet, you know, in practice, the main thing that expressed itself was holding up individual women icons, folks like Afata Shakur of the Panthers and the Black Liberation Army, Madam Din of the National Liberation Front, and others. But by focusing on individual women, they lost the sense of women collectively and of women's oppression, and really, in practice, consistently pitted anti-imperialism against women's liberation as a form of, as a politic.
Well, John Sanbamatsu has written critically of what he calls the politics of expression of the new left. That is, the idea that activists should go out and express their outrage without thinking about whether it would achieve their goals or alienate people, and that it would serve, you know, if people are conscious enough, they'll just rise up, seeing the model of sort of cutting edge radicals. Do you think that the Weather Underground was guilty of this?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a difficult issue, but certainly what at the time was described as the FOCO theory, which came from Régis Debray's book Revolution in the Revolution, which was his analysis of Latin America, particularly what seemed to be the reason for the success in Cuba, as you know, the actions of a small group of committed guerrillas really inspiring the masses. And I think the range of underground groups at this time period, not just Weather, but the full range of them, you know, had a sense of that, you know, armed struggle was the highest form of struggle. And even when they were working with mass movements and really trying to see themselves as auxiliary components of above-ground left expressions, then there never was a kind of appropriate balance between what role this would play. And the earlier part of your question in terms of, you know, expressing outrage without thinking about, you know, strategy or being effective, I think is something that folks I interviewed really kind of slipped and saw it as really the basis for their actions. That, you know, the militancy emerged from this broader context of revolutionary upsurge globally and so many people embracing revolutionary politics and ideas within this country, that it seemed like a time that, you know, it wasn't enough to just state your outrage to the war or state your solidarity with the black movement, but that there are real possibilities to be part of this winning movement. And I think they saw that their actions, you know, were to contribute to that. Obviously, it was more complicated in practice, but I think they did give consideration to strategy.
But this ties to another question about how they viewed the American public as a whole, particularly, say, working class white people. They obviously did think that black people, people of color, were essentially, you know, the most conscious elements of the population. And this connects to one thing I was thinking about when I was reading the manifestos of the Weather Underground, which is the central focus on imperialism rather than on capitalism as a system. And it's interesting because historically the critique of imperialism comes out of the Marxist tradition, where imperialism is seen as a product of the expansion of capital. And while the Weathermen and Weatherwomen identified as socialists, they didn't see class as the key cleavage of U.S. society. I know you may see things differently, so what's your take on this?
Yeah, I think several things, and it's a really important conversation, and one surely we won't solve in the short time we have left, but it's a really fruitful conversation to have, so I appreciate the question and glad we're talking about it. I think, you know, their focus on imperialism and on national oppression, you know, seeing black people as a colony of the U.S., really was an argument about class. And seeing, you know, the black colony as engaged in class struggle against the U.S. empire. So where that fit or where that left white working people, you know, was a more complicated position that I don't think the group or really many folks in the U.S. left in the 70s really could pinpoint. I think many groups oscillated or vacillated between a kind of romanticization or a demonization, and that's true just within Weather. I mean, you see a big pendulum shift from their politics in 1970 as to their politics in 1976. But I do think that their analysis of imperialism included capitalism and included, you know, these colonies as kind of leading edges of the class struggle within the U.S. and globally. I think their analysis of white privilege, again, was not complex enough, but at least initially, you know, afforded white working class folks a role in the struggle that I think they kind of abandoned and again vacillated around later. But this notion that, you know, living an empire gives people, particularly white folks, a level of material benefit is something now that's been accepted by most of the left, and even, you know, you can get a degree from a respectable institution studying the way in which that happens. So, I think it's definitely a complex issue in ways in which they missed things and fell short in a bunch of different areas. But also, I think there's some degree of nuance in their analysis.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you about the plight of political prisoners in this country, which is something that you touch on in Outlaws of America. Prisoners like David Gilbert, who we heard from earlier, as well as many Black Panthers, are still in jail, and there seems to be a lack of knowledge on the part of present-day activists about who these prisoners are. So just in the 2 minutes we have remaining, I wonder if you can talk about, give us the names of some of the political prisoners from those times who are still locked up and what you think people can do to support them. And I just want to say it's particularly appropriate to look at this question right now, since beginning in the 1970s, African Americans within and outside the prison system have paid tribute during the month of August to Black liberation fighters who were incarcerated.
Absolutely. I think folks like Jaleel Muntakim and Robert Seth Hayes, two Black Panthers who have been in for more than 30 years, who were both just denied parole yet again this past month, and folks like Oscar Lopez Rivera from the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, Leonard Peltier of American Indian Movement, Noumia Abu-Jamal here in Pennsylvania, former Panther and journalist, Marilyn Buck in California, another white anti-imperialist, are just some of the dozens of political prisoners in this country coming out of those movements of the 60s and 70s. And of course, we have political prisoners more recently, whether folks from the Earth Liberation Front or from, you know, opposing School of the Americas or the Cuban Five or a range of other cases. But this is a way that the government, I think, persecutes a long-running war against dissent and really tries to dissuade anyone else from embracing any kind of radical politics by locking up our friends, families, comrades, and mentors in prison, often with life sentences, or at least lengthy sentences, and repeatedly denying them parole. So I think they deserve our support, not just as friends, but because really they're in there for all of us.
And just really briefly, like 30 seconds, how can we support them?
Various letters to parole commissioners, monetary support, particularly for the prisoners of color who generally lack funds, groups like the Jericho Movement, Prison Activist Resource Center, Malcolm X Grassroots Movement are some of the many groups doing support work for political prisoners.
And that's the voice of Dan Berger. He's an activist and author of Outlaws of America, The Weather Underground and the Politics of Solidarity, recently published by AK Press. He's also co-editor of Letters from Young Activists. We have links to Outlaws of America and other writings by Dan Berger on our website, againstthegrain.org, where you can also go to download podcasts. Dan, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.